The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, everyone. I think we can begin this afternoon session, or this lunch session.
Speak from here.
Good afternoon. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Danny Bradlow. I teach at the law school, and I'm director of the International Legal Studies Program. It's a great pleasure for me to chair this keynote address and lunch meeting at this wonderful conference on the EU at 50 years. I think this conference exemplifies in the best possible way three of the things that we try to do at the law school. The first one is we try to make sure that whenever there are important events in international law, that we can mark those occasions by having a conference and exploring what the legal significance and issues created by those important events are. And I think we'd all agree that one of the important events this year in the development of international law is the 50th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome, which has had such a profound effect, not only in Europe, but around the world. The second trend that we try to do in the law school is to make sure that we have as much of a student-driven law school as we possibly can. And this conference is due to the energies and the credit of the law students, both the LLM and the JD students. And it's wonderful to see this is as an effort of the LLM Executive Board Conference Committee and the International Trade Law Society. Because not only is it an example of how student-led activities can develop at the law school, but also of the benefits that come from collaboration between LLM and JD students. And the third thing we try to do in the law school is to make sure that our presence in Washington is as rich and that we can benefit and interact with the Washington community as much as we possibly can. And so to have Ambassador Chariot, from the German ambassador speak here, is a perfect example of how we can benefit the law from being in Washington, and we hope how we can help enrich the diplomatic community as well while we're here. As I said, this is really a student-driven conference, and there are two students above, I think, anyone else who really have worked long and hard hours to make this conference happen, and they really deserve all the credit for the success of this conference. And that's Clementine de Brosses, who from the representative of the LLM Conference Committee, and Matt Simpson, who's the indefatigable former chair, I guess, at this point of the...
Got another couple of weeks.
Still the chair of the International Trade Law Society. And I think because of all the work that they've done, they really should have the honor of introducing our keynote speaker today. And so I want to invite Clementine to say a few words and then Matt to introduce our speaker.
I would like to say a few words about the conference, addressing some questions that you might have. Why celebrate the 50 years of the Treaty of Rome? Why in the U.S.? And I think it's important to remember that the U.S. were at the creation of the EU, 50 years ago, and that without their help, financially and really more than financially, substantially, in the creation of the European communities. And so that's why, being in the U.S. now and addressing the 50th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome is really a really important symbol, at least for me, I think. And also, I think it's interesting to be there now and assess like the last 50 years and ask the question, what are the achievements of the EU? What went wrong at some point? Why such famous magazine is asking the European Union a midlife crisis? And but I think that there are also some great achievements and that we have some great challenges coming next. And I think that the German ambassador, Klaus Chariot, will be there to answer your questions about this.
Thank you very much. And Professor Bradlow, thank you very much for the compliments. However, the Trade Law Society, there were many of us that were working on this. And so I thank them as a group. I also thank Dean Grossman in the Founder Celebration, Jennifer Dabson, who never seems to be in the room when we thank her, but is always most deserving of that thanks. Without her staff and her efforts, none of these events would ever come to fruition. So I'm very grateful to them, and also to Professor Nicola, who is in the back of the room there. She will be speaking on the panel this afternoon. She really was the spearhead of this effort and the expertise that allowed us to assemble such a high-quality group of speakers. In preparing just a few words to speak today, I, unlike Clementine, don't have the personal background or experience with the European Union, although Ambassador Bruton suggested, I guess it might be possible for Canada to join at some point. So far, we're not joining, and hopefully it's not a path we're going to go down anytime soon. But I did a little bit of research and was very much struck by the wording of the Berlin Declaration, which was signed and came out just 3 days ago. In particular, the very profound statement at the end, which was, "For we know Europe is our common future." And though they directed this statement towards the citizens of the European Union, I very much think that the statement resonates around the world. As today's conference demonstrates quite clearly, whether we're talking about trade or human rights or competition policy, the environment or labor, or whatever topic you may choose, a unified Europe is a reality for all of us and must be part of our discussion. For the past 50 years, the leaders and people of Europe have forged their alliances into a very real, clearly a very active, and most would argue a very effective model of unification. But as we admire the Europe that now stands before us, we must also recognize that this model is not perfect, and I think much of what we heard this morning which made this a reality and was very clear that perhaps the model is not perfect, and perhaps models don't necessarily need to be perfect in order to be successful and a useful model. And so I encourage all of you, as we proceed with the rest of the conference, not only to reflect on this momentous occasion that is the 50-year anniversary of a unified Europe, but also to challenge the model that sits before us, to ask questions, to be provocative, and engage the reality that Europe is not only part of all of our common future, but as Clementine made very clear, and as I think today's conference makes clear, we, as academics and as students and as members of the global community, are also very much a part of Europe's future. And so with that, I am very pleased and honored to introduce and welcome the German ambassador to the United States, Ambassador Chariot. He presented his credentials to George Bush on March 13th, 2006. Shortly prior to becoming the ambassador, he served in the office of the German foreign minister as of April 1988 as head minister of the minister's staff. In 1998-99, he headed the International Security and North American Directorate, and from 1999 to 2002, he was political director and head of the Political Directorate General. In these years, he participated in negotiations to launch the European Security Defense Policy and the Berlin Plus Agreements, the NATO-Russia Council, and the Stability Pact for Southeast Europe. Shortly prior to becoming the ambassador, he served as Secretary of State, the highest civil service post in the German Foreign Office. And so with that, it is our great pleasure to welcome Ambassador Chariot.
Thank you very much for the extremely warm welcome, and thank you very much for having this conference. I think this is a great idea because I believe we really have reason to celebrate. And not only do we Europeans have reason to celebrate 50 years of the European Union, which I believe is a huge success story, but I think also here on this side of the Atlantic, you have reason to celebrate because to a large extent, this is also your success. And let me just say a few words, and then I would very much like to have questions and answers after. But let me just shortly say what the history of the EU was, how it came about, and why I believe there is no alternative to a strong Europe and to a strong transatlantic partnership in the future. You see, after 1945, when Europe lay in ruins, we had the great blessing of having some political leaders in practically all European countries, Robert Schuman, Jean Monnet, Konrad Adenauer, Paul Henry Spaak, de Gasperi, and many others, who thought we have to break with all traditions. We have to break with what has governed world politics in the last 300 years. And that was the so-called Westphalian system, created in 1648 with the peace of Münster and Osnabrück, which was based on balance of power politics. Two powers or three powers try to balance emerging or rising powers. So there was always a balance. But also, there were always wars. There were wars all over the place. And you don't have a single year from 1648 onwards where there didn't was war in Europe. And so they said, this system has failed. And they also said, and I quote your later president, François Mitterrand, who said, le nationalisme, c'est la guerre. He said, nationalism is war, means war. And I think those two insights together, that the old system had miserably failed and that the answer of nationalism wasn't really an answer, these two insights made him try something radically and totally new, the politics of integration. The effort to try to put together those industries which were at the time considered strategic, that was coal and steel, and therefore, especially those five people, but also others, they put together in 1952 the European Community of Steel and Coal. A breathtaking idea, because it meant that you shared strategic industry, that you voluntarily gave up sovereignty over your strategic industries, and that those strategic industries couldn't be used against each other anymore. Totally new idea, had never happened before. And actually it was a great success. And a few years later, actually 5 years later, 5 years later, the same six countries, France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg, got together and extended the idea and said, we go one step further. We also try to do it concerning trade, and we try to build slowly over time, step by step, common institutions. And they created the so-called European communities. This was in 1957, and that's what we celebrate this year, 50 years. And over time, this process continued, and it went step by step further and further. We later created common institutions, we renamed ourselves into the European Union, we created a common security and foreign policy, and then also in 1999, we went another step further and created a European security and defense policy. We actually had a common security strategy, and by now we are thinking of even further, but maybe we come to that in the discussion. What I want to say here is, from the very beginning, it was the United States who supported that idea. It was the United States who actually not only understood that the time had come for this radically new approach to politics, but that it deserved support. This is not something which goes without saying, because you could also say maybe there's a future rival, or maybe that is not a good thing to have a strong united Europe. But the United States supported from the very beginning this integration effort in Europe, first materially with the Marshall Plan, but also then ideally supporting it politically. And I think it's to the great, I think I must say, we are extremely grateful in not only in Germany, but in all over Europe, that people like Harry Truman, like George Kennan, like George Marshall, John McCloy, that they all supported from the very beginning this idea. And actually, you were the first country outside the six countries which recognized this European community on coal and steel. It was the United States who were the very first. Just like when you became independent, the first two countries to recognize you and to enter into treaty relationship with you, you know that, are France and Germany. And this is no coincidence. So you did 180 years later exactly the same what had happened in the late 1700s with the United States, when first France recognized you and then Prussia had this treaty on amity and friendship and also recognized you. Those were the two countries. And I find it very interesting that also in the 1950s, it was the United States, again, recognizing also the EU long before many others did, and you sending first an observer and then also an ambassador to Brussels to represent the United States at the European Union. This is the past. I just repeat, it was only possible because the United States supported that. And I think in 1989, when we had the unique chance to unite the whole continent, when the wall in Berlin came down, and when there was an opportunity to unite not only the western part of Europe, don't forget in 1989 the European Union consisted only of 12 countries, 12 Western European countries. And then again, when people on both sides of the Atlantic saw the chance, here we can unite, here we can fulfill the old European dream to unify the whole of Europe. Again, it was the United States who supported that. And actually, I think also with the help of NATO, which took in the new member states also, I think we now can say we have a European Union of 27 countries, and the real miracle is that we have in Europe 27 democracies. This is not something which is easily said, and it was not preordained that countries like, for instance, Spain, after Franco lost power, or Portugal, where you had a dictatorship for 30, 40 years, authoritarian regimes, or the whole of Central and East Europe, you had dictatorships. And now nobody thinks about it anymore, that you have the real miracle of 27 democracies in Europe. And this, of course, was only possible by the European Union and, of course, also by NATO. But I think without these two organizations, this would not have been able to achieve. Now, what I would like to say is, and this is the great advantage, the European Union probably is the most successful project of peaceful change in the direction of liberty, in the direction of freedom, in the direction of rule of law ever undertaken. And I think one should not take that lightly, because it's an achievement which is there to stay. 27 democracies, 27 states where you have the rule of law. And I can tell you, without the incentives of the EU saying, if you don't fulfill those criteria, you can't be a member. Without these incentives, I think many states in Europe would still not be democracies. The future. I think we need a strong Europe, because no European state alone is strong enough to defend the values which we share, which are the values of the Enlightenment, the values, as I said, of rule of law, of protection of minorities, of democracy, of freedom, protection of the media, free speech, human rights. All this is what Europe stands for. And actually, that's what unites us with the United States, because you stand for exactly the same values, the values of the Enlightenment. Now, the realization we have to make is that none of us alone, nobody in Europe, can defend these values worldwide alone. No France, no Britain, no Germany. So Europe has to be united. Europe has to get its act together. Europe has to be strong. And that's why we will put forward a new effort to try to get the constitutional treaty being reconsidered and being accepted before 2009, because it enhances Europe's capability to act. But the other idea, which I think is very important to realize, is that also the United States alone is not strong enough to defend these values or to defend what we stand for. And therefore we need the strong Europe, and we need a very close cooperation between the strong Europe and the United States to defend these values worldwide. And if you look at all the questions, but I will finish now, and I think we should discuss that in the discussion period, but if you look at all the modern problems which we have, Iran, Afghanistan, Kosovo, Mideast, climate change, energy, poverty, pandemics, HIV, AIDS, the avian flu, organized crime, terrorism, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. None of these 10 problems, I challenge you, none of these 10 problems anyone can solve alone. Neither the United States, as powerful as the United States are, nor Europe. And therefore, it's absolutely essential that we have a strong Europe, which is united to act, but a strong Europe, which is a strong partner for the United States, and that we have this cooperation between Europe and the United States. And that's why we prepare now the EU-US summit. We, as you know, have the presidency for the time being. We prepare this summit with a quite ambitious agenda. We will talk about all these problems, all these challenges, which we can only face together and solve together. But we'll put on the agenda also some other questions which are forward-looking, like energy, like climate change, like what we call the new transatlantic economic partnership, which is regulatory diversities which hinder actually exchange. So the basic idea is, let's be very ambitious, and I think only if we are united do we have a chance to defend these values. But now I would like to turn to the discussion. Is that all right?
Yes. Well, let me open up for Bjorn.
Hi, my name is Bjorn Sorensen. I'm a student here at Washington College of Law. I'd like you to talk a little bit about the future of EU foreign policy in terms of two areas. One, in terms of the potential conflict between a standing EU military force and longstanding NATO commitments, and whether those are contradictory or somehow complementary in the long term. And secondly, the prospects of a EU seat in the United Nations on the Security Council, for example, where France and the UK would be very reluctant to give up a seat, and Germany in itself is aspirational toward a seat on the Security Council in an expanded setting. And how does that work with a common EU foreign policy?
Yeah, I think the first question you asked, both actually are key. The first one is one which has kept me busy the last 10 years, so I could give you a very long answer. I'll try to be short. It is absolutely essential that we in Europe realize that after 1989-1990, the world has changed. You see, between 1945 and 1990, we were hiding behind the broad shoulders of the United States. We didn't play a strategic role because these were the times of the Cold War, and the players were the United States on this side and the Soviet Union on the others. And Europe couldn't do much, and actually we enjoyed that to a certain extent because we didn't have any influence, but we didn't have any responsibility. But the world changed. And like it or not, after the dissolution of the Soviet Empire in 1991, there is no Cold War anymore. And therefore, if we like it or not, we have to play a strategic role. We have to play it. It took us a while to understand it. We didn't understand it in Bosnia yet in the beginning because each of our countries had a different position, and we actually did not have the feeling of any responsibility what was happening there. So we learned it the hard way. We learned it by 200,000 people dying in Bosnia. I think it was also our mistake, of course also their mistake, but also our mistake. So we learned it the hard way. We were a little bit better than in Kosovo, where we actually acted quickly. And we were even better in Macedonia, where we succeeded in preventing a civil war. But you see, what we learned, and this was exactly the outcome of the Kosovo crisis, is we have to have a military, also a military capability, we as EU. And that's why it happened to be the German presidency in 1999, therefore I know a little bit about it. We put together what we call ESDP, European Security and Defense Policy, which means Europe, for the first time, realized it had to act outside its own borders and outside the narrow defense which was given to NATO. But of course, we saw to it that this should be done in close cooperation and operability with NATO, because none of the European countries has the forces to have a NATO force and an EU force. And therefore, we made sure that those forces which were created were interoperable. And actually, practically all countries in Europe, most countries, France, of course, is an exception, but most countries have exactly the same troops assigned to, in 1 year, for instance, we have troops which are assigned this year to the EU battle group, and next year they will be serving in the NATO response force, same troops. And therefore, we need the same traditions, the same rules, the same standards, and interoperability. And of course, you need interoperability also, because then you will put together, when you have an operation, some EU forces and some NATO forces, and all this is I think, very important. We are not yet talking about a standing army. The reason is that this is impossible for those countries which used to be neutral before they became EU members, like Finland, like Sweden, like Ireland. And therefore, we have to be a little bit seeing also their problems. What I can tell you already is that we will have a very close cooperation of this ESDP force, of the EU battle group, and the NATO response force, the NATO troops. This will be two things like the Lego, that Lego stones, you know, you put them together and you can combine them in very different forces. And actually, we already had also operations where we had just an EU force in Congo, for instance. We had 2,000 soldiers. It was just French, mostly French and Germans, and who made sure that elections could be carried through. So I see a great future for both, for ESDP and for NATO, working jointly together. And we have the so-called Berlin Plus agreements, which allow the EU access to NATO capabilities and capacities and assets. On your second question, UN Security Council. I think the Security Council, first of all, has an extremely important role to play, because there are only two ways under the Charter of the United Nations how you can legitimately use force. One is self-defense under Article 51, and the other one is when the Security Council says here force is needed because there is a threat to international peace and security. So it's very important. And I think the 11 countries who were selected in 1945 for the Security Council to become permanent members, and then later on, a few years later, it was extended to 15, they, I think, represented quite well the picture in 1945. I think by far it was the United States and Soviet Union, the most powerful countries. There was also Britain, France, and China. I think a very good reflection of the situation then. The problem is, already a few years later, this situation changed. And actually, I think today, it doesn't really make any sense. The reflection, the representation on the Security Council is totally different from what the realities are. I think it doesn't make sense to have China as a permanent member and not India, just to give you one example. The only reason is that India was a colony in 1945 and became independent only in 1947, historical coincidence. But otherwise, nobody would think of saying China should be a member and India not. Why? I mean, just because India is a democracy and China not? Is that the only reason? I mean, it doesn't make sense. You know, it's really, it doesn't make sense. Or it doesn't make sense that you don't have any African country there. I mean, why? Why should you exclude a whole continent? Doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that you don't have a single Latin American country there. You see, that actually was already a problem in 1945, as you can read in the materials for the charter, because Brazil wanted to be a member of the Security Council, and they said we veto this whole UN Security Council, this whole UN charter. We want to be a member of the Security Council. At the time, it was the Soviet Union who argued strongly against it, and they said it's then too many countries who are close to the United States, and therefore we don't want that. And actually the compromise was that Brazil, now since 1945, is always the first speaker in the General Assembly. That's what they got in return. I would say Security Council seat is probably a bit better than that. But I mean, that's your consideration. I think it's also not right that the second and the third largest contributor, Japan and Germany, are not in the Security Council permanently. I think it just doesn't make sense that you exclude countries which provide about 30% of the UN budget. And also, I think, have a large role in projecting peace throughout the world. So I think the representation in the Security Council must be changed, and I think the only way is probably to extend it. And so you know that there were plans to do it, to extend it to 24 or 25. I still believe there is a chance to do that, not now, but in the longer future, because, you see, the Security Council can only act if it carries legitimacy. And if it doesn't carry legitimacy, it will be much very, very, very difficult for the Security Council to have this authority it needs. On a European seat, as you know, we would be ready to have that, but I think this must be a decision which has to be done by all countries. And I just don't think it's realistic in the near future. I think the realistic scenario is an extension of the number of the seats. And then I would say we should have one or two Africans, we should have India, we should have Brazil, we should have Japan and Germany.
Mr. Ambassador, I'm Jim Kenworthy, an adjunct here. I'd like to, you have to liken the history of the EU to almost a continuing gestation, starting 50 years ago with 6 countries, and to 10, then to 15, to 25, and now 27. I have 2 questions. What is the ultimate range that you foresee for what you might call the final participation of countries in the EU? I just, for instance, late last year was in Armenia, and Armenia wants to accede to the European Union. There are, I know, several other candidates in the Balkans. So my question is, what do you foresee, what time do you foresee, and how do you foresee when they finally close this so that an integrated European Union then exists? And secondly, what about the Constitution? The Constitution was supposed to bring together all of the treaties and other documents and instruments that make up the legal and regulatory regime, you might say, for the European Union. But now the Constitution is effectively moribund, at least because of the negative votes. Is there any chance that the Constitution can be reconstructed? And what is that chance, given that there might be even more countries coming into the EU?
Thank you for the questions. On the range, the treaty is explicit. The treaty says very clearly any country which is a European country, so it has to be a European country geographically, who subscribes and implements the Copenhagen criteria can be a member. Now, Copenhagen criteria is just another word for what I said, the Enlightenment. I mean, they just got together, it happened to be in Copenhagen in the early 90s, and they put all these things which I mentioned, democracy, human rights, rule of law, free elections, liberty, protection of the media, all these things, I mean, freedom of speech, they put it all together, and this is now the Copenhagen criterion. And whoever fulfills that, not only in theory, not only professing to do it, but also implementing it, and who happens to be a European country. So New Zealand is out, to just give you an example. Although they might fulfill the Copenhagen criteria, they are out. And other countries who happen to be in Europe but don't fulfill the criteria are out as long as they don't fulfill the criteria. Now, you say that's a nice description, but give me an answer on my question. And you see, I won't. I won't because we have been asked this question already ever since I'm in the Foreign Service, that's 31 years, and I'm so glad we never gave an answer. You know, I'm so glad because I believe if people would have been asked, let's say in the 70s or in the 80s, they would have said, yeah, it should be maybe the whole of Western Europe. I think nobody thought about the possibility that the wall would come down and that it was possible, it would be possible to have Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic in there. And who would have thought in the 1970s that today the Baltic states, at that time part of the Soviet Union, would be part of the European Union? Nobody would have thought it. And so every definition would probably have excluded the Baltic states. Nobody thought about it. And so I'm very happy that we never defined that and that we never fell into traps like your question and answered that. You see, so you won't get an answer from me. I think it is wise to not answer some things because history is open. History is an open process. And I think one should never, you see, one doesn't think about certain things at times because they seem so unlikely. Baltic states, you see, if you would have asked me, my family comes to a large part from Eastern Germany, although I lived in Western Germany, but I didn't think that we would be reunited in 1990. I didn't think about it 5 years before, didn't think about it 1 year before or 2 years before. And so let's not exclude things. So no answer on that one, purposefully. But we stay with the definition, any European country who implements and subscribes to the Copenhagen criteria. On the other question, constitution treaty. I think it's absolutely necessary to enhance Europe's capability to act. You see, don't forget the rules which were drawn up, they were rules for six. And the rules were made in 1957. And I don't know if you have read Parkinson's Law. I read it with great pleasure. And Parkinson says very clearly, if you have a group greater than 10 or 12, you have to change the rules. And usually decisions are no longer made in a group which goes beyond 10 or 12 people. If you have a cabinet which is bigger, you get a kitchen cabinet of those who really have the power. He makes very beautiful examples of how it works. And you see, of course, the same is true for the European Union. You see, I have, for many years, while I was in the Foreign Service, we were just, most of the time, we were just 12 members. And you were sitting in a small room, and you would sit, let's say, the furthest person away in the room was not as far away as you are now from me. You know, you saw when he smiled, you saw when he was angry at you, you could immediately react, and I think it was possible to find solutions in the room. It's no longer possible. Nowadays, when 1.5 years ago I was in the European Council, you had television screens, you know, because the room was about five times as big as this one, and the person furthest away was about, now I would say, five times the difference, the distance between the two of us. And you can't find a solution in the room. And you see, with 27, you need a totally different rule about how majorities are put together, how consensus can be used. I think you can forget about the consensus rule, basically, I think, for most questions. 27, you will never get any decision. And so I think we have to change the rules. There's no way out. You see, we I think it was right to enlarge the European Union. No question about it. As I said, the biggest crisis management and crisis prevention project of all time. But of course, we also have to deepen integration. We have to establish new rules for voting, for finding a majority than before. And therefore, whatever you call it, I don't care if you call it constitution or whatever, I don't care. You can call it basic treaty or whatever. But we need the change. And you see, don't give up on it. We have two countries who voted against it. We have 18 countries which have ratified it, so the relationship is 18-2. And we have 7 countries which have not voiced an opinion on it. I would say the chances aren't that bad that we get something before the election for the European Parliament in 2009. And the German presidency has said, and we will do that, we will make a proposal at the European Council in June how to proceed. It will be a procedural proposal, but as you know, procedural proposals also have a grain of substance in it. So I'm not that pessimistic.
There was a question. It was answered, actually.
My name is Mary Mullen. I work with the Bosnia Support Committee. I wanted to know what you think the European Court for Human Rights and the European Commission on Human Rights has done for Northern Ireland and the EU for Serbia and for Belarus. The problems in Belarus and the fact that it is the only, I think, country in Europe that's not democratic.
Has not been what?
Is not a democratic country. Belarus.
I didn't quite hear you.
Belarus.
And what about
I thought, from what I read, from what the former president from the Finnish government said, that Belarus, he felt, was his biggest error since he was president, because he was not able to help it be more democratic. And I was wondering what you felt about what the EU can do for Belarus to become democratic. Also, Serbia and the fact that they are not able to turn over the two war criminals, Karadzic and Mladic. And I was wondering how you have, or have you helped in the situation in Northern Ireland?
First of all, the question of the European Court on Human Rights, I think it is a huge step forward. I think we can rightly be very proud of that. I don't know of any other group of countries which have given up sovereignty to an international court to such an extent. You know the history. It started as a commission, and in the beginning you needed the consent of the state. But all this is history, and now you can go as an individual to the European Court on Human Rights, and I think it's a huge achievement. I'm very proud of that, and I think Europeans can be proud of that. They, of course, take individual cases. They don't take, let's say, country cases, but they take individual cases, and, of course, sometimes governments aren't happy with what they decide, but I think that's the freedom of the judges. You know, they are independent, and I think they do a marvelous job. I think on Belarus, we have a man there, Lukashenko, who is very far away from being a Democrat, and actually suppressing the opposition, suppressing free speech. We try to help the opposition. I personally have made a point of seeing the opposition at least once or twice a year. I know that other European countries do the same thing. I actually have received them also here in Washington in my current function, because I believe that we have to support them morally, I think also politically. I do not think that they have a chance to win the next election. I think it will be won, in quotation marks, by the current government of Lukashenko. But you have to work long term. And I think in the long run, they will win at some point. It will take a long time. I think they are not yet as well organized as they should be. But I think they're getting their act better and better together. And in the elections after the next one, maybe they have a better chance. Maybe they get people in Belarus out of their lethargy. You know, there is a certain lethargic sense in Belarus, which is not working to their favor. On Serbia, this is a very difficult question. You know, we have made the delivery of Mladic and Karadzic, who are the two worst criminals, we have made that as a condition for further progress on getting closer to Serbia. Now, we of course have also an interest in not losing Serbia. You see, there is, as you know, an ever stronger nationalist party in Serbia, winning more and more votes in each election. And I think we have to be very careful now when we have the Kosovo decision on the table, and you know that on Monday Mahdi Ahtisaari presented his package for the status, for the future status of Kosovo to the Security Council, to the United Nations. And this will be very difficult to swallow for Serbia, very, very difficult, because as you know, Serbia did not agree to the package. And therefore, I think we will have to find a balanced way of trying to help Serbia a little bit out of their situation. And of course, we will not make compromises on the International Court, on the International Criminal Court on Yugoslavia. But I think we should try to help them to cooperate better with them. You know, that's what we are trying to investigate these days, how we can help Serbia to walk over the bridge, to increase cooperation with the International Criminal Court, it's called International Tribunal on the former Yugoslavia. And I think there are ways, but it will be very difficult because the mood in Serbia is very difficult these days.
The other country was Northern Ireland. If you want to say anything on that.
Yeah, Northern Ireland, I'm so pleased. I'm so pleased. I'm so pleased what happened. It's just almost a miracle. I think actually, again, the European Union is more responsible for the success than what you see, because I think through the fact that Ireland and the UK became member of the European Union at exactly the same day, I think it changed the whole relationship. It changed the relationship between those two countries, which was, as you know, a very difficult one. And I think without this common membership in the European Union, what we have seen these days would never have happened. But I think it's almost a miracle. If you would have asked me 20 years ago, will this happen in your lifetime, I would not have been sure. So I'm very pleased. I'm delighted. And I think it is a great achievement.
Are there any questions I haven't seen on this side?
Actually, if I could ask one quickly. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the situation in Cyprus right now and the role that the European Union is currently playing, the discussion about the United Nations playing a greater role, and what your thoughts are on the role of the European in Northern Cyprus or in settling the Cyprus dispute.
You see, Cyprus is a member of the European Union. I think there was an opportunity missed when in the referendum on the plan by Kofi Annan, only the northern part of Cyprus voted for it, mm-hmm. and the southern part voted against it. I'm very sorry about that. I think it was a missed chance. I think it is one of those most difficult problems, and I think it will unfortunately now take quite a few years again. You know, if you miss these things, even if it's by a small margin, it takes usually quite a while until you get a new opportunity. I'm very sorry about that. I thought we were this close, and I very much regret that at the time the people in the South decided to vote against it.
The role of religion in this debate or possibility of adopting a new European constitution. And it seemed that Poland was very unhappy by the fact that the German presidency didn't even mention the Christian roots in the German in the European constitution. This was a big debate during the Valéry Giscard d'Estaing proposal of having a preamble. He explicitly did not want to mention that. And that brings us back also to what are the religions of Europe, and we cannot really exclude Islam from the various possible religions that are on the map now in Europe. How would the German presidency deal with that conflicting issue in Europe?
I think there is no better way than how it was put in the current draft of the Constitution, because you have a wide range of very different tradition on that in Europe. You have some governments, some states, which consider themselves almost Catholic, for instance, or almost Christian. They would say that. There are others, like, for instance, France, where I think it is a very important part of the Republican tradition that the state has nothing to do with religion, laic. And I think there is no other compromise than what had been found on the Constitutional Treaty. I don't think we will be able to improve on that, or anybody will be able to improve on that. It was already a huge debate while the convention was meeting, and all kinds of proposals were raised. And I was in the room when we had hour-long discussions on that subject, and none of us came up with something better to that. You see, religion does not really, I would say, nowadays play as much of a role as you might expect in Europe. The numbers of people who are member of a church is going down. For instance, in Germany, out of the 82 million people, only half are member of a church any longer. It used to be very different. It used to be 95-98%. It's a little bit more than half, but I mean not much more than half. And I think this is typical for quite a few countries. And even if you look at more relevant figures than, for instance, like church attendance, you would see that Europe is getting less and less religious. Quite a difference to, for instance, the United States, or to the Mideast, or to other parts of the world where religiosity is on the rise. In Europe, it's not. And therefore, I don't think this is an important question, but it's not the key question.
If no one else has a question, I'd exercise the prerogative of the chair to ask a question and to ask about something we haven't talked about much, but I think it's one of the major interesting achievements of the European Union, which is the creation of the euro. I was asking a question about the euro and the consequences of the creation of the euro. And an area where to be frank, the European Union's position is not viewed as being particularly helpful, which is the situation of reforming the governance of the IMF, which is seen as a critical issue, not only for the IMF, but for the global economic system, and where Europe occupies about between eight and ten, depending on the year, of the seats on the IMF board of directors out of the 24 directors. And it seems that the only way that One of the major ways to get change and to democratize the representation on the board of directors is to have the Euro region as a whole become the holder of a European seat, seeing that it only has one currency in Europe. And I was wondering if you'd be willing to comment on that.
First of all, unfortunately, it's not yet true. We have still in the EU 15 currencies. Unfortunately, I regret that, but we have 13 countries which are part of the Euro, and we have 14 countries which are not. So it is not true yet that we have one currency. Although I do grant you that the Euro is a huge success. It's a huge success, and I think you will not be surprised. It was not popular in my country, and actually it was decided by my government against popular will. The vast majority of Germans did not want to give up the D-Mark, but actually we believed it was a necessary step of giving up sovereignty, a necessary step of also leading by example. You can't, you have to go ahead by your own example if you want to get into a new phase of giving up sovereignty. So we did it out of conviction, but against popular will. Now, I believe it's a very successful thing. It's very successful, and you have seen that not only the value of the euro has been appreciating practically all the time. You will also see that the currency mix all over the world is slowly changing towards the euro, and I think there can be no doubt that you will have in the future two and a half leading currencies. The dollar will remain the number one, but the euro is already clearly the number two. And the yen, of course, is, I would say, more a regional currency, but it's also a very important currency. But I think it's very good. I think it has given stability to world financial markets. It has balanced out difficult differences between various European countries. So I think it's a very good thing. On the IMF, this is a difficult question. And you see, we would be ready to give up a slight percentage share like some others. But it's a very difficult question, I think, too complicated to solve it in the next 2 minutes.
I think we'll use our 2 minutes for the last question.
All right, I hope this question isn't too general. My name is Michael Lorry. I'm a student here. I was wondering, a lot of people, myself included, think one of the biggest successes of the EU was to encourage other countries as a carrot that if they change their political institutions, that they can join. Is there any way to do that, maybe with the US or the EU, when with other countries, developing countries, that we might not be willing to incorporate into our political system whatsoever? Is there a way through economic means that we can influence some of their social policies?
To a certain extent, we're doing that. We have always had agreements with non-member countries, for instance, with the North African countries, nothing new. We also have an agreement, a partnership agreement with Russia, for instance, also with Central Asian countries. We actually want to go one step further with what we call the European Neighborhood Policy, where we try to put together more incentives for countries to develop in the direction which we believe is the right one, but of course the ultimate choice is theirs. Stopping short of membership to try to create incentives for this kind of development. This is in the process of being defined, and let's see how it works. It's too early to already assess if this is really radically different from what we had before, the partnership and association agreements. But let's see. We are thinking about it. We are doing it. We are working with some countries on such a new mechanism, but it's too early to say what will come out of it.
Ambassador Shariat, I want to thank you very much for a very frank and thought-provoking session. Thank you very much. I also want to invite Clementine to give the formal vote of thanks for you.